All right, Matthew, welcome to episode 96 of the Performance Advantage podcast, where we bring sports science to the people with myself, Dr. Will O'Connor, and Dr. Matt Miller, sports scientists. Today on the show, we're talking tech, and we're talking big problems, simple solutions that are actually really complex solutions with James Alvery, ex-professional triathlete from New Zealand, and he has developed, or I guess helped found and develop, the company called Race Ranger.
So everyone knows that when you're drafting, you're cheating. Actually, I only found this out, and we get into it. So if you're in a triathlon and you're drafting, you're cheating. And the only way to know if you're cheating is someone says, hey, that person was cheating, and that's it. So there was never any way that existed to stop people from drafting in a triathlon until Race Ranger came around. And I got to say, man, I'm like super G'd up at the moment because we just chatted with James after the show. And like the journey for Race Ranger is so similar to Breakace. And, you know, hats off to the little companies that are like making a change in our sports, because let's face it, like, innovation in most of these industries is when something is slightly lighter, and that's not real innovation. So the companies that are actually making change and making big sacrifices to make these changes come and to make our sports better and more fun and just more effective and just stop guessing, I love it. And it gets me really excited, and I can't wait to see Race Ranger out there. So we have a really good discussion with James. You'll really like it. If you like what we have to say, we also have sports science courses. We help athletes and coaches understand how to use power meters. We have fundamentals of running with a power meter and fundamentals of mountain biking with a power meter. And we also have introduction to exercise science and how to use sports science to train more effectively. So we have those courses available to you. And we just love educating athletes using technology to be able to do that. So those are worth CEUs for USA Triathlon. Check that out on performanceadvantagepodcast.com. And check out the links in the show notes for all the goodies to follow us, to follow James and Race Ranger, and to get your hands on the course or Breakace.
Here is James Alvery from Race Ranger. All right, James, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, guys.
It's all good. So, Race Ranger, we've seen it floating around Instagram and a few other podcasts, but a lot of our listeners probably aren't hardcore triathletes or in the scene. And so they're probably, not super aware of, one, what Race Ranger is, and then why you would need it in triathlon. So if you give us the cliff notes.
Yep.
Elevator pitch.
Yeah. So most triathlons in the world are non-drafting. So you're not allowed to slipstream or ride too closely to the guy in front of you or girl in front of you. And so you've got to keep generally a 12 meter distance. So any longer distance race, so half Ironman and Ironman sort of distance, is generally, this is the rules, no drafting. And the way this is policed is with referees on motorbikes patrolling the course. And generally there might be 10 or 15 of those going around a 90 kilometer, generally a loop. And they're guessing what the distance is between the riders. And the riders are also guessing themselves. And so there's a pretty big margin for error at both sides there. And generally they don't agree, the athletes and the referees.
It sounds ridiculous, honestly, like when you put it like that, like everyone's guessing, even the people policing it.
Yeah.
Like they don't have like a 12 meter stick on the front of the motorbike to be like, ah, nah, you're like 11.9 or anything like that.
Yeah. And the other thing is the athletes can also hear the motorbikes coming from quite a way back. Tesla haven't made a motorbike yet, so there's no sort of silent, it's not fleets of deadly silent motorbikes out there. So you just adjust your distance when they're coming. And it's such a contentious thing that drafting penalties are the only penalty that you can't protest against in triathlon. It's just because it's totally, subjective. It's the referee's word is law. So Yeah, it's basically something I've known about since I was a toddler watching my dad at races. Grew up as a triathlete myself, and yeah, it was just something that people are always talking about after a race and arguing or complaining about. But it just, it's just become part of the landscape, but it still pisses everyone off basically. So yeah, that's the problem.
So there's the problem, and you have the solution to kind of what are you trying to do with your product?
So we basically want to cut down that subjectiveness and reduce the error as much as we can. So we've been working, my co-founder and I, Dylan, he's based in Christchurch, I'm in Wanaka, been working on this problem for quite a while. We first sort of decided we were going to try something in the end of 2012, way back 10 years ago. It's 10 years now, oh my goodness. And we sort of tried had some ideas around things, and we tried lasers on bikes. So projecting a line of some sort onto the road ahead of you or behind you, that would be a guide as to how close you need to get.
So like a visual laser.
Yeah. I have a bike light like that. It's like sits on my seat post, and it shows a bike behind me. So and then like a lane, so you can see what the bike lane is, so a car doesn't ram into you. So it'd be something like that.
Yeah. The issue was that that's great at sort of 1 or 2 meters away from you in low light conditions, but when you're in a bright sunshine in the middle of the Arizona desert, and the light needs to be seen 12 plus meters away, you need a really, really powerful laser that's basically illegal in most countries for consumers, because they're quite dangerous. So it was actually quite interesting. The green laser is the one that's the brightest if we were to do it that way. But yeah, we basically tried that on some bikes, and we also thought, you know, it's actually probably quite easy to manipulate that angle for the athlete. It's hard to, you'd have to set it because every bike would have a different mount angle. But then you have to, have some way of making it fixed at the right place. So we scrapped that. About a year later, we tried, this is just like a hobby in our spare time. Like, oh, this is a big problem. Let's have a go at fixing it. And we tried ultrasonic sensors. So it's basically a sensor that sends out a sound wave, it bounces off things and comes back. And it actually, the technology actually works quite well. We actually formed a company at that point, that was early 2014, for the first time, and had a private sort of electronics guy look into it for us. And you can get pretty good accuracy, like sort of at 12, 13 meters away, you're at sort of 30 centimeters accuracy, which is probably better than the referee's naked eye. Couple of issues we came into was that as you're going along, it bounces off anything. It's not just
quite noisy signal.
Yeah,
so you could bounce off the motorbike, for example.
Motorbike, a road sign, a tree, and also you can't work out which athlete you're actually. If there's multiple athletes, you
so if someone was overtaking, it could ping.
Yeah, like, potentially. Yeah, we were just trying to find a way to measure the distance at the start. And also it's quite affected by temperature. So if it heats up or cools off quite a bit during the course of an Ironman, which it can do, that affects how it's calibrated quite badly. So that that was a no-go. And yeah, for a few years, it was sort of just a hobby in the back of our minds. Like, we talk about it over some beers. Like, what can we do? Surely someone's going to solve this problem with technology. Like it's all around the world. And there was a period there where people were just saying they wouldn't do races anymore because this was pissing them off so much. It was unfair. So, eventually had a personal thing. My best man, passed away in, end of, 2015. And a year on from his passing, had a heart problem. He was a really inspirational guy. His name's Lauren Vidal. He's Andrea Hewitt's partner, if you guys remember the Kiwi triathlete, French guy. And he's quite inspirational for me. He came fifth at the Olympics, and we used to train together. And basically my wife, about a year on from his passing, was sort of saying to me, we need to do something here. We need to do something here for ourselves. You know, we've got decent jobs, but to get ahead in life, be good to start our own business of some sort. And we were thinking of doing like a bakery or something like that. It's more mundane, but eventually she sort of said to me, hey, what about your drafting thing? What would Laurent do? What would your mate do? And he was the kind of guy who just, nothing was impossible. He would see things right through and see if things were possible or not. And so I basically just spent like a month online at the start of 2017 and trawling wireless research forums and all sorts of techie stuff that was totally foreign to me, and came across this technology that seemed to look like it would do what we needed on paper, going through the data sheet of the component. We got quite excited and took it to another, we went and visited Christchurch and met with about eight electronics developers, type little companies. There's quite a few spun out of Tate Electronics and Jade Software in Christchurch. It's quite a little hotbed down there. And met this guy who had worked with this sort of stuff before, and he got pretty excited about it as well, Marcus. And we've been working with him on it basically ever since. That's where we sort of went from it. It wasn't a straightaway solution. It wasn't like, oh, if we put Bluetooth into this thing, it would work in 6 to 9 months, you've got a product. It was sort of this technology was designed at the time for something quite different, and we had to repurpose it and reconfigure the firmware on it. So it was basically erase everything and write it from the ground up and cross our fingers as we went that it would work. And we hit a few dead ends along the way. We finally, after sort of 5 years, got to the point last year where we had it working in theory, and we had it small enough that we were okay to put it out there for the first time to show people what we're doing. And we raised some money and things are sort of accelerating now. So yeah, that's where we're at.
I see Matt just nodding his head through the hole.
Yeah. Yeah, I was saying, James, before we got on, we're following kind of a similar journey where we're creating this product that actually you're like, why is no one doing this? And then you get into it, it is kind of hard. So there's that part. And I've had a similarly very long journey as well. And also as a non-technical founder as well, which means you need a good team.
Yeah.
But I guess one of the things I'm thinking about is like, how big of a problem is drafting?
Oh.
Yep.
So like, I get it. Like, I hopefully everyone listening is like, yeah, I know what drafting is. But like, how, if you draft, like,
yep,
can you literally be at 11 meters, get past the referee? The referee's like, oh, yeah, pretty sure that's 12. And then you smoke the person that you were drafting off of in the run. Like, is that something that can happen?
Yeah, that's the general concept. So it's a lot. The closer you get to a point, the easier it is to follow. You know, if you're right sort of up within sort of 2 meters of the rider ahead of you, you're using up to 30% less energy. Less power you have to put out. You can free will for a lot of the time. It's definitely, basically it's seen as cheating in the sport. It's meant to be a pure effort on your own. Like if we could, you know, the most pure triathlon would be everyone set off at 2 minute intervals, like a Tour de France, and there's no interaction, or you've each got your own lane or something like that where there's zero drafting. It's sort of in the short course racing in the 90s, when the sport was sort of developing, it got so hard to break people up because they're going so quick and they're over shorter distances that at the top level, the sport decided to allow drafting so that they could get into the Olympics, because it was a farce, basically. It was really unfair. It was hard, not a fair competition. And so they went the other way, allowed bunches, which has been great for TV, and has sort of taken the sport in sort of two different directions. But the bulk of people doing triathlons are still, about 85% are still doing non-drafting events in this sort of pure and time trial effort. In terms of, like, to your question, obviously you should always do your market research, right? Is this something really people want or would eventually pay for? And the sort of surveys we've done, we gave people, didn't tell them anything about what we're doing. We said, about your athlete experience when you're at an event, you're doing this Ironman or whatever it is type event, gave them a bunch of options and said, which one is the most, which one would you like to see improved to improve your competitor experience on the day? A range of things like, registration set up, what's in your packet, how many people are doing the event, this kind of thing. The number one thing for 65% of people was drafting. They called it out. So, we put that together with what we knew about just hearing people getting pissed off about every race. And yeah, if you guys know any triathletes and you ask them, hey, what's drafting about in triathlon? Is that something that annoys you? Like, you'd be prepared for like, you've poked the bear, right? They're gonna let you have it. So my mate, we had a guy who was looking at investing in us, and he sat next to someone on a plane who had an Ironman backpack, and asked them that question and couldn't shut him up for the flight. So
one of those guys, you start talking and they never leave you alone
on the plane as well.
Like, oh, see you later. No, we're never going
to
see you.
Because you're down in Wanaka, James. You're taking one of those direct ones from Auckland to Queenstown. You start someone up. You're like, well, we're in for 2 hours here. Okay. Better put my headphones in, get the message.
But that's good feedback though. If you can hear someone rant, right?
Yeah.
They're like really complaining about it. I guess then the next question is, like, how do you get them to pay for it? Is this something that, like, everyone's going to buy?
So the idea around that is that obviously this has to be something that you can't just have one or two athletes using it. It's got to be basically everyone
right?
in a race. Yeah. It's like a timing chip. So you turn up at the race and you get given your timing ankle strap chip for these type of events. And a company is there delivering that service. And the idea is that, you know, our company will deliver the anti-drafting service at the event. So there's quite a bit more to them than the timing chips, the coil, RFID coils. But same concept. We arrive at the event early in the week, package them up. They go into the race packs. The athletes put them on themselves, and they do their race. We take them back after the race while they're running, after they've racked their bike, and recharge them up again and head to the next event. And so the cost is paid to us by the event, and it's passed on to the athletes as part of their entry fee. Yeah.
That's a pretty good way to do it. It's like, because every time I have a timing chip on my wrist or whatever, I always forget to give it back. And then you're in for like $30 for your timing chip. Like, or you send it back. But you guys can just go collect it at the end. That's pretty handy because all the bikes are there. You just clip them off and away you go. Nobody even knows.
All lined up. So we're designing So they're wirelessly recharged, these devices. I should actually probably talk about what it is in a minute, but they come off the bikes and they go into an oven, we're calling it, but it's like a big tool chest with drawers that you slot them into, and that goes back into the van and recharges. So hopefully we have some volunteers help at that point to get them off the bikes.
There could be a lot of bikes. How many people are doing these kind of events where you'd be at? Like, how many competitors would you see?
Yeah, so in New Zealand, we've got two major long distance events. There's Challenge Wanaka. They both unfortunately not happened. They've been postponed this year, but Challenge Wanaka and Ironman New Zealand in Taupo. And even like Taupo is pretty big, and it's for New Zealand, it's sort of 1,200 to 1,500 athletes. But to put that in perspective, the average in sort of Europe and North America is 2,400 in those events, in your Ironman and 70.3. And there's about 120 to 150 of those in Europe and North America. So some weekends you've got 7 or 8 events across Europe with that many people racing. So large numbers basically.
So then it brings up a lot of questions. Two for me. One, the consistency of the mounting. And then how do you track it?
How does it work?
Yeah. So, those are just two off the top of my head. Like,
sure. You're going like to put straight it into the dragon's den.
Right? Yeah. What are you doing? No, I'm not.
Calm down, Will.
I'll, maybe I describe what Race Ranger is and then I'll sort of.
Yeah. Do that.
Yeah. So Race Ranger, what we've come up with is a system where each athlete's given these two devices, two each, and one goes on their front fork, on the side of the front fork, and one goes on the rear of the bike, either on the seat post or the seat tube, so the frame below the seat post. And the rear one has a bike light built into it. So this is the guide for the athlete behind. So as you're coming up to someone in front of you, the closer you get, some lights will flash at you and change color and flash pattern depending on how close you're getting. So that's the general way it works. The second part is that the referees are sent information about the worst offending athletes. So if you are shown those lights and you're in the zone that you're supposed to make a pass, so it's the illegal zone, is sort of 12 meters, but when you enter that, you've got 25 seconds that you're allowed to make a pass. Anything over that 25 seconds in that zone will be transmitted to the referees locally, and they'll be able to see where you are on their tablet in front of them, and ask the motorbike driver to, hey, just head up the road 300 meters. There's someone who's been drafting for the last 2 minutes. So I want to go check it out, or I just want to apply a penalty straight away through the app. So there's two kind of things it does. So around mounting, we sort of chose the front fork side of the fork blade. Generally, forks are all generally at the same angle, plus or minus a couple of degrees. And it's not somewhere, bikes generally all have a fork and they're all pretty clean and uniform. There's nothing really to get in the way in that area. The handlebars, everyone has a different setup up there, and it's a pretty personal area. You've got your Garmin mounting things. Some people have quite a bit of nutrition and bottles and all that sort of stuff up there, and everyone has a different position. So we saw a lot of challenges trying to mount up there. And then at the rear, there's generally enough real estate to take the devices at the rear, and if on the seat post by itself. Because some time trial bikes, they don't make really, really small sizes for particularly small people. Some people have to slam their seat almost on the frame, on the top tube. In those cases, we're probably a bit tight for real estate, but being able to mount it quite low down on the back of the bike is quite a good thing, because as long as the light can be seen from behind, just slightly above the top of the rear tire, we're okay. So generally that angle is also fairly uniform. There's probably a bit more variation in the degrees of the seat tube angles. That light can be seen basically at a range of angles. So that's kind of okay. And we went from there, and we're just actually still working through now actually what material we make the mounts out of. Initially, we had a prototype with a clip, so it had different profile mounts made out of plastic, and the uniform rear unit just clipped into those, and then they were zip tied onto the bike to hold them on. We're trying to, I don't want to break any news because we haven't quite pulled it off yet, but trying to get a system where there's a uniform piece of rubber, so the back of the unit just turns into a piece of rubber basically with some flaps, which can be shaped whether you've got a round standard round seat post or a knife shaped thing or a D profile, which a lot of the aero bikes have now. So we wouldn't need to have different mounts. It would just fit on everything basically. So.
Oh yeah. Like some of the,
my light.
Yeah. They have those rubber based ones that kind of pull around.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how do they talk to each other? Like you said, like that was one of your initial big challenges. So,
yep. So the initial technology we found was called ultra wideband, and it's what's come out in the Apple AirTags, I think they call them, the little find my keys type little tags. And it's so UWB, it's commonly called UWB. And basically it can measure the distance between two units really, really accurately. So even at quite decent distances, they can sort of have a 10 centimeters or better accuracy, which is really impressive when you actually see it in working. And so we played with this technology and said, okay, that's great. Two devices. I'm standing there. You're standing here. We can make a light turn on and off. But we need a lot more athletes in a general area. And you have, you might get a bunch of 25 coming together. And then there might be another bunch coming the other direction on the road, another 25. So we'd need it to kind of work for those kind of situations. And so the bandwidth for the ultra wideband, we started to run into issues at around sort of 15 to 20 athletes all together. They're all trying to measure the distance to all the others multiple times per second, because we do want it to be a pretty live measurement. And so we sort of said, oh, that's not good enough, basically. And so we got a secondary sort of measurement system, which is more of a guesstimation, an initial guesstimation of where everyone is. So we're using our GPS position and broadcasting that over Bluetooth. So it's not a Bluetooth pairing like we know with our headphones and keypads and stuff. It's just a sending out messages of where you are and who you are. And other rear devices are receiving those and comparing it with their own GPS position. So we can get a rough approximation of where you guys are when you're sort of probably 30 to 60 meters away. And I can go, you know, the GPS position's not amazing. It's sort of 1 to 2 meters, and I've got my 1 to 2 meter error. You've got your 1 to 2 meter error. So you're somewhere around sort of 30 to 35 meters or, you know, in that range. And then I can decide to flick you over to the ultra wide band measurements once I decide you're a priority that I want to range to really accurately. So ranging's the process of measuring distance between two. That's where we got the name from. So, yeah, that's sort of how it works. So it's got a ultra wide band, really accurate measurement, but sort of a preliminary step is GPS comparison of positions over Bluetooth low energy broadcast advertisements. And then the lights is pretty simple. And then obviously the connection to the referees is a part we actually haven't fully built out yet into the current prototypes. We just built that first feature of making the lights go on and handling that. But that's planned to be done with LoRa technology, which is it's kind of like a local cell network without cell towers. So the referee carries a sort of a modem-sized little gateway, call it, and they pick up any incoming information that's from athletes within sort of 5 to 10 kilometers of them, ahead or behind them. That's the main technologies in there. There's a wireless charging coil as well, that's also can run in NFC to sort of scan them and things like that. So yeah, there's sort of 4 antennas in there, which you guys will know you need to kind of keep as far away from each other in the right orientations as possible. So that's how we sort of ended up with this shape. It's as tight as we could get them without breaking the rules of what the components each ask for in terms of how far they should be away from batteries and other antennas. So
yeah, we've been having that as well at the moment with our antenna on Break Ace, because the antenna sticks out by the charging port, so you need to be able to access it. But also the way we need to fit everything in such a small area, and that needs to be metal, but you don't want a lot of metal near your antenna, so you need a lot of plastic built around that. So then now we're talking about like multiple different pieces to kind of make the hardware just so the antenna works, because the antenna is also going to be moving with the bike in relation to what's picking it up, which is your phone. So it's actually pretty complex to be able to do that. But the way your technology is working, like, it actually makes ours sound pretty easy, because it's just like some strain gauges, and then it talks to your phone, and then everything is analyzed later. Whereas yours, like, you need to do it in real time. You need to talk with like hundreds of different bikes, figure out which one's a priority. I like the solution for figuring out which is the priority, but then you also need to tell the referees. The referees need to then do something about it.
Yeah. So the initial like MVP that we're trying to roll out this year is we're not having that referee connection turned on yet. We're just focusing on the light system to make sure we get the drafting measurements dialed. And that might be enough. You know, athletes might, and referees as well, referees can use the lights. They might use that as their guide from now on. We might not have to sort of go that extra step. There's a big demand for live tracking as well to be done better in triathlon.
Oh, yeah, man, live tracking.
Yeah.
Well,
particularly on the bike. So.
2022, yeah. You know?
I know. It's ridiculous. You know, Quark had that collector
where
you could hook up like 7 amp plus devices. It ran on 3G, which shows how old it was. I don't even know when 3G came out. Like 2007 or something like that. That's when the iPhone came out. So maybe it was. That's old. And they just discontinued it, so it doesn't work anymore. Mm. So I have a collector.
Oh, you got one. All right.
Yeah, and it you can't do anything with it. They actually had a pretty cool like live tracking thing on the, I forget what their platform was called, to use that. You could see
it
all
just,
the
it just
devices.
Never worked.
Well,
do you remember they tried it for Ironman World Champs? Maybe 1 or 2 years? They had the Quark page, and it was just...
They tried it for Enduro World Series too. But the problem was like you couldn't tell if it was on. Like, I mean, you could tell if it was on, but you couldn't tell when you connected a device, right? So if you had a power meter and two tire sensors, you couldn't tell if they were both connected to it. And then you go for a ride, you're like, is it working? Or like, is the GPS good enough here? You don't really know until you come back. I don't know if that's a 3G problem or what, but it was huge as well.
Yeah. And I think that sort of fizzled out. It wasn't really, it was quite expensive for what it was probably. And you know, companies like Apple and Garmin, you know, we've got SIM cards now in watches, you know, digital SIMs. So if someone really wants that, they can just get one of those Apple watches in a way, and their family can track them where they are. But if you could, there's basically the way they're doing live tracking at the moment, the Ironman is still based off the timing pads every, you know, 15 kilometers or so, which makes it quite hard to spectate an Ironman. It's a big day for someone to watch a race in person, but also from home and not quite at the event. We're actually tossing up adding live tracking next rather than the referee connection, because there's probably more of a need for it. And just giving, you know, the course map and a moving dot every, you know, might be 15, 30 seconds, you get a new ping and you know exactly where your athlete is. That's sort of after this current step. So we'll get this one working really well first.
Yeah. Can you receive information like from a power meter or anything like that?
Not yet. And it's all in there technically to be able to do it. There's a Bluetooth, you know, receiver in there.
Oh, okay.
And plus stuff can all be done. And another idea we had was to output the drafting distance to a head unit. So as you're getting closer, you can, to a point, watch that distance close up from 30, 29.8, you know, see how close you are to the person in front of you. In that we put the lights on the bike in front of you because we want you to stay looking ahead. We don't want to be looking down at the computer the whole time. So yeah, it's another reason that we put the light signal on the other bike rather than your bike. Just to keep
it's a good idea. Get the triathletes like looking around, taking in the scenery and stuff instead of just staring at their Garmins.
Yeah, on the air.
Be good for them. Like, look at where you are. You're in Wanaka. Yeah. Like, this is beautiful. Stop looking at your computer.
Yeah, you can just watch this little flashing light out the corner of your eye.
Yeah. That's pretty cool. If you're anything like us, you got like a list of ideas of all these things that you could do. Now I got to stay focused and like actually do this one thing. Yeah. Like make sure that's dialed.
Yeah. And but, is this totally, you know, crucial? If we don't put it in, will people still like it? We initially had an idea of putting a forward facing camera in that was sort of like a proof point. So every time you entered a draft zone, it would take a photo every 1 second. So if you wanted to say, hey, I wasn't drafting, you could then reference these photos after and say, look, you were, and it was off number 552, and here's the photos. But yeah, nice to have. Maybe later.
So like the defensive approach.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool. But you got to be thinking, like, well, you know how Tesla, they have cameras everywhere?
Yep.
Right? And they decided to, I'm not sure what the technology was that you can use besides cameras. So I think Toyota uses something else.
LiDAR, is it?
Yeah, I was going to say that, but I'm not actually totally sure. But Tesla's like, well, actually cameras are better because we can just create vectors from all these images, and then that vector becomes what we look for in the software, whether it's a line, a person on a bike, a dog, whatever, make sure you don't hit it. But you got to be thinking, technology like this, it could be used other places, right?
Yeah, for sure. And it is being used in other areas already. Originally when we found it, it was pretty much solely used in warehousing. So it's kind of like a high precision indoor GPS. So you'd have, and this was sort of our initial challenge, is you could buy these chips, and they'd either be programmed as an anchor or a tag. So you'd have fixed anchors in really known places in a warehouse around the corners of the roof, basically. And then the tags would be on things you wanted to track, like people or forklifts, or even, you know, individual pallets. You could see where they are. And that was how it worked. And then we had to basically reconfigure it so that everything was a tag and the tags were as good as anchors, basically. So that's how where it came from. And then, yeah, the Apple iTags, find my stuff. There's some people been trying to do sort of proximity COVID sort of tracing programs with it, because actually there's ultra wideband and a lot of new phones coming out. So it's, you know, with the Apple tags, it's how they detect those tags. And Samsung have got it in there as well. So yeah, there's heaps of things you can do with it. We have a couple of ideas, but we're pretty sure someone else is probably doing most of them. They're, you know, sort of military and drone type stuff, which is not our area of expertise at all. So we know we've got a problem that is worth solving, and we know a lot about the problem, and we've got some good connections in the triathlon sport. So we're just trying to solve that one problem to start with, and see where it goes from there. Start to for the future. So
yeah, because Garmin has that one. I'm not sure if it's different technology. Where I think
Varia.
Yeah. What? How does that work? What does that do?
So that's just a radar, like a normal radar. It's looking for big, yeah, cars and other objects like that, and it shows you on your head unit how close they are getting. So that's quite cool stuff. But so you're obviously looking at things behind you, and then it turns on your bike light behind you, basically when something's getting close enough that you want them to see you. Yeah.
Yeah, it's only rear, so it's kind of, you know, like trees don't run up on you from the rear, like they do at the front. You know,
I think it's kind of looking. It's designed to look for cars too, so it's sort of looking for big metal objects, as I understand. Yeah.
Well, you know what though, like cars should be looking for you, right? Like, how distracted are you on a bike versus how distracted is the driver? Like, something, because there isn't anything at the moment that's, I don't know what, if you call it an analog car, that's what we call bikes. Like you have an e-bike or an analog bike. But if you have just like your standard 73 Mustang or whatever, and you're driving along and you're playing with the radio because you're on AM, I don't know. I'm just imagining someone in a car that doesn't have a lot of technology and they're very distracted texting. There's nothing to actually say, like there's a biker up there, don't hit them. And obviously riding on the road is extremely dangerous because of distracted driving.
Yep. You know, it's definitely something that could be done. Our sort of effective range is probably gets a bit patchy around 80 to 100 meters. So the speeds cars are traveling at, you probably want to look at something a bit more heavy duty to solve that problem properly, because you wouldn't have much warning from when someone's actually coming up on a rider. But I can definitely see, you know, like those LiDAR and autonomous car systems where they start giving out things to, you know, sensors of some sort of transceivers to people or to bikes and say, hey, if you've got this on your bike, Tesla cars will recognize you and will automatically avoid you better than they would if they're just using cameras. But yeah, the camera versus sort of direct connection, so we're actually looking for athletes, we're not looking for anything. With autonomous driving, you don't want to hit anything, right? So you it's like the ultrasonic start part at the start. You're seeing everything, and that's good because you don't want to hit anything.
Right.
But we only care about triathletes in this case. So yeah.
So what were some of the, from the initial outset? Because I've, having been around the triathlon world, there's been people throwing out solutions to this problem for ages, and on the outset it seems real simple, like the range finder laser thingy that beeps when you're in the zone and tells the referee has been the one people kind of come back to, like, why doesn't it just beep, you know, and then it tells them and then that's it. The biggest challenges that you didn't even consider, like what have they been like?
So that's where we initially started, like how do we measure this distance really accurately and show the athletes and get it to the referees. One of the challenges that we didn't really think through until we got into it was, okay, so you cross this 12 meter distance, we know when you've done that because we've worked that out somehow. How do we actually know that you've completed a pass? Like, what's the moment that one rider actually inches in front of the other and they've either done it within the illegal time or not, and they've cheated? And so that's been another challenge is we had two devices per athlete for a few reasons, but one of them is that by having four devices in that passing scenario, two on each bike, you can triangulate really precisely the moment 1 inch is in front of the other. So that's something we didn't really consider beforehand. And I guess other challenges is just, yeah, as everyone will say, just how long stuff actually takes compared to what you think and what you set out to do. Every plan, just even though you might add, I will add a few weeks or a month buffer there, just multiply everything by 1.5 times because stuff comes up or it takes longer than people expect. Like the last 2 months have been, we pretty much thought we had our system ready to run at events, and there was just a couple of things to sort out around, you know, the charging and things like that. But it turned out to be, you know, 2 months work to actually get everything to go to sleep, because we'd got it all working when it was awake, but we hadn't worried about making all the individual components go to sleep. So when you hit sleep or close your lid on your laptop, it all just goes to sleep, right? And it seems quite simple, but actually there's a program telling every little component in there that it needs to shut down and what that means and how much power draw that means for each component and what it should do when it wakes up again and how it should be woken up. So all these things that just have taken longer than you'd expect. Be pretty frustrating sometimes.
Yep, I can identify with that. Like we've had, like, the magic of what we do is really on the web side. So we have a web app that analyzes all your braking and tells you where you can get faster.
Yep.
But then we had to make hardware, and like I thought software was hard, and we had to make hardware, which sounds like it sounds easy because there's hardware everywhere and all these things exist. But then just doing a simple change in firmware, like, how does this device turn on? Yeah. That's like a few weeks work because, yeah, okay, this device normally turns on with an accelerometer by rotating, but we need it. Ours doesn't rotate. So we need it to turn on when it vibrates. Like, oh, well, okay. Actually, that's a problem. We need to solve that. And that just like gets all added onto the list of all the other things you're planning to do.
Yeah.
And then you got to manufacture it as well.
Yeah, it seems simple, you know. These phones have just ruined it for everyone because there's so much going on there. Like, thousands of people put thousands of hours into making a phone. And yeah, I just, you know, whenever I see like a new phone come out from a little brand that no one really cares about, or, you know, no one's going to buy me any of those, you know, there's Samsung, there's Apple. I'm just like, how so many people and millions of hours went into making that. And it's people just like, oh, that's crap because of this or that, it's not quite as good as the other.
That's true. I think about that too, but
yeah, same age. The other thing, like, this journey is like, oh my god, that must have been so hard, just like the way we want to get you on as well, because it, you know, these simple solutions to simple problems are often like you're finding, you know, it's been a decade now and it's like
yeah,
but like a really important point though. And this like kind of speaks to like the passion for the sport, right? So a really important point with those crappy phones is that they're going to sell millions. Mm. Like literally millions of people are going to buy them. So the investment to have 1,000 people working on it is worthwhile, right? So maybe the company will be shut down, or they'll have some sort of technology that is valuable to another cell phone technology. I don't know how many cell phones exist in the world. Does everyone have one? I don't know. That'd be billions, right? Yeah. That is a lot of phones. And if you want to accomplish something like going to the moon or whatever, it's all doable. You just need a bit more cash, right? But what we're working in these sports that we're just really passionate about. And actually, at the end of the day, like, not that many people do them. Like, there are a lot of people that do them, but not as many as will buy a crappy phone around the world.
Yeah.
So we're like, I guess I'll speak for myself here, where I'm super passionate about what I do. Love it every day. Wake up every day, think about Brake Ace, go to bed, think about Brake Ace. Like, I want to make mountain bikers faster. I'm like, oh man, if I just would have been like this passionate about LiDAR on Teslas, like it'd be way more economical. Yeah. Right?
Exactly.
But yeah, it's like, so it's a hard journey, isn't it?
It is, yeah. It's probably not the recommended path. Like, everyone has a different path of their entrepreneurial journey, but for me, like, I'm not a coder I'm not an engineer at all. So I'm not able to do any of the real work of building this thing. which has been kind of good because it means I've had to find people who can do it, and I can focus on the other stuff that still needs to be done. But I can also, I've been able to, you know, I keep a day job. I work at Specialized Bikes. You're wearing a giant t-shirt. Haven't mentioned it till now. it's all right.
Red versus blue. It's a big debate in New Zealand.
Yeah. But, you know, I've been able to, you know, still there. I'm still working there. And it's meant that we don't have this sort of, we've got, you know, we've still got urgency about what we're doing, but if the project hits a roadblock, you know, and it has hit a number of roadblocks along the way where we don't have funding for a few months or, you know, something just hasn't worked, we can pretty much, we don't have a lease and all these sort of a range of employees. We can just put things on hold and reset. It's not sort of, it's all over. It's getting a little bit like that now, and it's, things are starting to snowball and we've raised money and, you know, we're trying to, got a big team sort of working on it, trying to, you know, hit our deadlines. But, yeah, it's been nice to get to this point sort of in our own time through an R&D journey rather than a sprint where it's like learn everything now and go for it. Don't know how we got onto that topic, but
it doesn't mean it's easier.
No.
Right? Like, but it's also hard doing a sprint and just developing as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
I find as well.
Definitely, yeah. I've learned a ton. Wouldn't take it back, you know, shut up shop tomorrow, whatever happens. It's I've learned so much about so many different things that I never thought I'd be interested in, to be honest. I was never into like computers or tech stuff at school, but now I just find it super interesting. So it's crazy how things change. Yeah.
So when do you think you'll, well, considering like all the challenges, when do you think you'll be able to like have this in the real world at like a major event and everyone's using it and be like, no one's guessing about cheating anymore, which sounds like a no brainer.
Yeah. So, we thought we were ready in about January, February to go to an event for a first demo.
Yeah. Cause weren't you going to be at Challenge Wanaka or something?
Yeah.
That got canceled, which maybe is a good thing.
It was convenient. That's some Challenge Wanaka was 20th of February was supposed to happen. And then Taupo Ironman, actually, what date are we at? Yeah, it's supposed to be this weekend. So the 6th of March. As I say, it's been kind of good that we have a few more weeks to up our sleeve until the end of our summer, basically. So we're aiming for a sort of second half of April now to have 15 athletes do a mock type event. And it's actually quite good that we can do it this way because we've only got sort of enough for 15 athletes at the moment. And if we just put those on 15 athletes at a race, we couldn't really guarantee that those 15 would pass each other and kind of be able to give us the feedback that we wanted. So being able to control it and say, hey, let's do a 5-minute ride and I want you two to pass you two and that kind of thing. We can run a whole lot of scenarios and actually manipulate to get the effect we want and get the feedback we want. So we're planning sort of two test days, one where we're sort of trying to show the accuracy of the system, so the measurement and the how quickly the lights come on after the distance changes, so the latency. So that's sort of a really precise sort of sports science type measuring filming session. It's really easy to do when you're standing still. When you're riding along, it's quite hard. We've tried a couple of times. And then the other day will be the group ride, getting the user experience feedback of how the lights go, make sure it all works, obviously, when there's multiple athletes heading in different directions. Planning that in sort of April. And from there, next sort of step is probably to go to some professional events. So looking at a number of races in the calendar second half of this year. There's one in particular, the Collins Cup. I don't know if you follow triathlon at all. The PTO, Professional Triathletes Organization, have an event where they have just 36 athletes. Most events sort of have up to 50 males and 50 women in the pro fields, which would mean I'd have to make 100 fronts and 100 rear devices. But this event ticket just has 36, so it's quite a nice number. It's quite a high profile event. So we're talking with them about potentially having them devices on their event, and that's in August. So just scaling it up really more and more. We've got enough parts to make 50 total. So we've sort of rationing our parts at the moment, because you probably know there's component shortages and it's really hard to get hold of things. So trying to make what we have go as far as we can while things are messed up. Hopefully they get back to normal in 9 months to a year's time.
So with the PTO, that's a 20 meter draft zone, right? That's what they're using.
Oh, so if you're within 20 meters, then you're cheating.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So different, this is the other thing. Different races have different.
Yep.
Right.
Protocols.
Right. Yep. Funny.
There's only the gold standard. Well, the most commonly used is the 12 meter, and that's the World Triathlon ITU, as they're called. That's their rule. Some pro races, such as challenge events and the PTO events, are at 20 meters. And yeah, we've made it fairly easy to adjust those parameters. Yeah. So yeah, works at those distances pretty well too.
Yeah. So what has been the interest or uptake of some of these? I guess you call them brands, like Ironman is a company, not really an organization like the ITU or the PTO. Like, are they, what's kind of the vibe in the industry from what you're creating?
Yeah, so it's building. We started talking to them all probably over the last 2-3 years, saying, hey, this is coming. It always sort of seemed, it seemed like, oh, that's really cool. Sounds good. Give us a call when it's ready, sort of thing. cool story.
Dude, and, it's the same journey. Yep.
Yeah. So our strategy's kind of been, we put out this sort of, we announced ourselves the first time publicly in November 21, and we put out a website and explained exactly what we're doing. But at that stage, it's an even cooler story, but still not quite where is it for real. So this test event is sort of meant to be, hey, look, this is actually real and it's on bikes and it works. Next step from there is to properly start talking to them and going and seeing them all. So at the moment, looking at booking a trip, now we can travel to the World Champs in St. George, Utah in May, and going to Europe from there and meeting with all the people at all the event companies and federations around the world to start sort of getting a bit of a plan to scale it up at their events. World Triathlon have been really supportive, the federation. They've been involved from right from 2018. And so there's another sort of side, with everything, there's an app, right? There's software. So it's for the referees to communicate with the system. And we actually got something basically working for that already, which doesn't receive the information for drafting, but it connects the referees on the day. So instead of using radios and making notes on pads, they can officiate with this tablet on the motorbike driver in front of them on a Race Ranger sort of harness that we've made. And they go into our app and they can apply penalties to numbers, and that goes to all the other referees straight away if they look up that number, and sends penalties to the penalty tent referee, so they don't have to actually drive there and get off the motorbike and hand over pieces of paper and this sort of thing. So that's kind of ready to go. So looking forward to rolling that out to federations, and World Triathlon's been really supportive in getting that out. That's sort of been really good, and they want to be sort of abreast of technology changes in the sport. So they've definitely had a lot of input and helped us announce it as well in November. They put out the initial press release, which went far and wide and gave us a lot of credibility to what we're doing. So yeah, getting there, I'd say, is the answer. We're we have particularly with Ironman, like they're probably the biggest player in the space, in the event space. We've had input from their head referee, Jimmy Riccatello, who's sort of an ex-pro who runs their officiating, that runs their drafting basically at their big events. He's given us feedback along the way and we're in touch with him. And we've got Dave Beach on board, who was used to be CEO of Try NZ. Went on to run Ironman Asia Pacific for sort of the last 5 years. So he moved on from there middle of 2021. But he's helping us as an advisor now on sort of how we should approach things and message things, and he's obviously got a lot of connections at Ironman, so getting there. Yeah, this year's gonna be a big year. Yeah,
it's cool. I think like when you first launch something or first show an idea, you expect the doors to be blown down and everyone's gonna come knocking. But it is a huge journey to you know, because we showed our first prototype in 2016 and it was disgusting. It was huge and ugly and it worked. But then everyone's like, okay, what do you do with it? And there were all these other questions that had to continuously be answered. Obviously, interest has continuously increased, but I think everyone's initial expectation when something new and revolutionary is launched is that, like, this is going to change the world right now.
Yeah.
But it does take a long time to, like, you got to show that it can work. And then once you got that, then things change pretty rapidly.
But yeah, I'm planning to take with me a few prototypes that I can actually put on athletes' bikes, you know, some pros, and they can ride with it and feel it for the first time, because that's when it's really seems real. And we've got it to a size that's sort of acceptable, and it's not, you know, that big ugly box that you always start with these things, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, it's getting close. Yeah, it's exciting.
Yeah, it's cool.
Sweet. Well, that's that's really fascinating. We're interested to continue to follow this journey, because I think, like, it's going to be a game changer when it's out and ready. Because it just, Matt, like, you don't really watch the races or anything, but you see these photos afterwards, and there's, like, at Ironman World Champs where they just try and pack as many people in. Like, it's a business, right? But there'll be like 50 people in a bunch, like bunch riding, and
on like
time trial bikes. Yeah. Cool. Triathletes on, awesome. It's just a recipe for disaster. But then in the pro races, people are getting penalties that could cost them thousands of dollars.
Right.
And it's just been a problem for everyone. People accusing other people of doing, you know, drafting. So yeah, I'm excited to see this in the real world, and I know, like, it's going to get there. And
we'll have to get you back in the Ironman's will. Just give it a jam.
I don't know about that. One thing I would like to see, James, I don't know about if you'd be a fan of this, but is actually a drafting Ironman. Would you be interested in that?
I'd be keen to watch. I guess there's that sub-7, sub-8 project that's happening this year. With four athletes. I don't know if you've heard about that.
Yeah. They're allowed a certain amount of paces across the race.
Like a team time trial, they're going to have some athletes drafting them so they can go as fast as they can, which is sort of has got a lot of people's back up about, oh, it's not a real Ironman kind of thing. But it is cool to see what they can do, I think. And I'll definitely be watching that. I mean, people have asked, like, when we were going for investment, one of the questions we got was, well, what happens if they just change the rules and everyone's suddenly allowed to just draft in these races? That would make your product useless. When I thought about it, my answer was, well, these events are privately run by companies, and if the athletes wanted that, that's what they would be offering right now, and nobody is, and no one has even really tried. It's quite dangerous allowing...
I don't even want to think about it. Yeah. A bunch of people who train on Zwift almost exclusively suddenly in aero bars together.
Yeah. And yeah, that whole pandemic Zwift craze has sort of made that bike handling skills worse, I think.
Oh my gosh. Oh no.
It's gonna be interesting to see how it goes this year, and that is another sort of challenge we get, is those big bunches in races. What's this gonna do to those races? You know, there's events where it's so packed that it's basically impossible to avoid drafting to an extent. There's no way to race 100% clean for the whole day because there's just so many people out there. And I guess the answer is that, yep, what we're trying to do is I guess give the athletes more, the referees more information, so it's not. It's not forcing everyone to suddenly get penalties. The referees will only be shown like the worst offending, so they can't see everything. They can just see the worst sort of five or six athletes will be presented to them around them. So if you're in those situations where it's busy and you're trying to avoid drafting, as long as you are trying to avoid drafting, you shouldn't show up on those worst offenders list. And then even if you do, at the end of the day, it's still the referees discretion whether they give a penalty, just like it is today. So they're using human judgment finally to say, yep, penalty or not. And if they see you popping up on their screen, but then they can kind of see that you, there was no way for you to avoid it, it's up to them still whether they give a penalty or not. So that's a common worry we get. People think, oh, this is going to cause everyone to get penalties all of a sudden. We don't want to cause that. We just want to encourage encourage fairer racing and give athletes and referees, you know, some objectivity around it rather than subjectivity. So.
Sweet. And where can we keep an eye on what's going on?
Yeah, got a website that needs a bit of an update now, and raceranger.com. But most of the stuff we've been putting is on Instagram. So just it's race.ranger. Yeah, that's sort of, social media is probably not my strong point, but forcing myself to put something up there every now and then. And we'll definitely, anything that's sort of just happening around testing or trial races will be up on there. So yeah.
Well, that's what people are mainly looking at, you know, just like how far along are you? Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, we'll look forward to following this journey.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for coming on.
No worries. Cheers.